Yes, the day may be coming when we'll have a sermon announced for April 1st, and it will actually be an April Fool's Day prank, but not this day, alas. A long time ago in a galaxy far away, I toured with a production of Seymour Barab's opera, Chanticleer. This is a short opera, one act with one scene, only four characters. In our production, with piano accompaniment and lights that were run by whoever wasn't on stage at the moment. The five of us toured to elementary and middle schools throughout New England. This was back in the day when I had access to touring subsidies offered by the Regional Consortium of State Arts Councils. And it was during this time that I learned how sensitive the ears of children can be. Yes, I get it. It was heartbreaking to me the first time I walked onto the stage, really kind of the platform at the end of the cafetorium, and I began to sing, and I watched all the first graders cry. They were very well behaved, and they knew they couldn't just run from the room. And they didn't cry too loudly, but huge tears, and they covered their ears to the extent they could. Subsequently, we put the second graders up front, and then the kindergartners and first graders, and the weeping ceased for the most part. You may know the tale of Chanticleer and Reynard, the cock, and the fox. It is a widely told old story, we think emerging from the Low Countries of Europe, that was captured in French in the 12th century, and the story is about Reynard, the red fox. This fox is a trickster who teaches by upsetting the way things are. Reynard is usually called to the court of Leo, the lion king, with a complaint by another animal, often Unzengrin, the wolf, or Tybalt, the cat, or Bruin, the bear, or Baldwin, the ass. His testimony about these animals reveals his essential contempt for the aristocracy and their minions, especially the clergy. Reynard displays a cunning that unseats those in power and reveals them to be fools. Now in the opera, Chanticleer is a portrait of vanity. That's interesting. Great. He has a beautiful voice, is quite wrapped up in that identity, and his own sense of superiority. But it is not only he who gets lost in that sense of superiority. His wife, Pertelot, understands both his artistic temperament, understands his pride as well deserved, and her understanding makes her superior. Superior to his six other wives, but superior to their owner, the farm widow. The poor farm widow knows Chanticleer to be her greatest possession, and so having him awaken her most mornings makes up for the fact that life for her is very hard, makes her somehow superior to all of her neighbors who have a really hard life too. A couple of years ago we had a beginnings half-day retreat with over a dozen new people and about a half dozen of our congregational leaders with folk. And one by one, the leaders of our congregation told their stories. Something like, I was once a fill in the blank, but I didn't believe that anymore. And I found First Unitarian and discovered it to be a better place, a better way of thinking, a better religion than the one I was raised in. Now this happened a few times. Our leaders spoke rhapsodically about this church, and I'm so glad so many people love this church so much. Not one thing anyone said was untrue. But a newcomer to our church, herself the daughter of a Presbyterian minister, asked, "Is this some kind of a supremacist organization? Are you asking me to feel myself superior to my father and to the family I love?" What a great question. This Unitarian Universalist faith that I proclaim, this liberal and sometimes liberating religion that I profess, is this a supremacist community of belief? Do we really think that we are superior to all others? Do we speak that way? Do we act that way? Might it not be better for us to say, "This place is the right place for me"? Or even, "I'm exploring what I know, what I believe in what I will place my faith at this time of my life. This is a great place for me to think a few things through right now. This feels like a good fit." I'm loving the online course that Becky Brooks is teaching right now, this exploration of the principles of our association. The principles that you'll find in our hymnals and handouts, and beginning next week in our new format of our order of service. These principles are not meant to be articles of faith, not meant to be statements of belief. They are affirmations that you use, and you congregations, I should say, make to jointly associate. They are the basis for us developing the sense that we are one community with over 1,000 congregational expressions. They don't belong to us as individuals, but they inform the basis by which we relate congregation to congregation. And they are not meant to be a statement of superiority. Chanticleer, on the other hand, cannot but think of himself as superior. "That rooster next door is so absurd. He tries to sing like a singing bird, according to his nature. But when he flaps his wings, expands his chest, and cranes his neck, oh, what a miserable creature. What a horrible racket. But when I sing, it's quite a different thing. It's cock-a-doodle-doo. It's cock-a-doodle-doo. It's cock-a-doodle, 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 cock-a-doodle-doo." This truth, this profound, by the way, you only get to hear the whole thing at a talent show, so some of you organize a talent show, and I'll show up in orange tights. This truth, this profound vanity of Chanticleer, what we moderns might say is the oversized ego of this rooster, is what must be upended by the fox, who will call the cock a fool. The fox tells Chanticleer that the only way he might surpass his celebrated, if already eaten, father is to close his eyes and puff up his chest when he goes for the high notes. And when Chanticleer does that, he misses the fact that the fox is ready to pounce. And so he does, and so he does. Unitarian thought sought to explain in a world not so long ago that assumed royal hierarchy the worth of those not nobly born. This happened in the great universities of Protestantism that were founded by and supported by the merchants who were traveling the world and creating international markets and tremendous profits. These men received royal charters and land grants and sometimes subsidy, but largely they were not of the noble classes, and as a matter of fact, they were competing with nobility. Their wealth, they proclaimed in the theological debate and religious principle, was an affirmation of their status before God. In a world where only a few were elect to receive a place in heaven, their bounty on this plane was an indicator of their sure access to heaven. And what was required of them then was to live lives of generosity, founding universities and hospitals and preparatory schools and great churches. This is a kind of superiority that formed our institutional memory and even the habits that were passed on without question from generation to generation. Our forebears proclaimed that it was individuals who make up the elect, that individuals shape themselves, and that the self can be a part of its own creation. The self-made man was part of the lore of churches like ours. Even as we began to find a liberal path with a more generous sense of what human potential could deliver, we held a very high opinion of the individual. We held it when William Ellery Channing spoke in pulpits like this one and asked of us that we use our interaction with one another to build up our character. Churches like this one were a way to tell the truth that we can be about bettering ourselves and bettering each other as individuals. That might be one of our noble truths, if we have them. But it wasn't until the 20th century, with such thinkers as John Dewey, that we began to throw away the individualistic understanding of the self. It isn't that a group of individuals fully formed choose to create something like a church out of entirely new cloth. Each individual was socially formed, and the coming together is about a social identity formed in particular social context. Social contexts create social customs which capture and form the individual. Dewey says, to a large extent, customs persist because individuals form their personal habits under conditions set by prior customs. An individual usually acquires the morality as he inherits the speech of his social group. The activities of the group are already there, and some assimilation of his own acts to their pattern is a prerequisite to a share therein, and hence of having any part in what is going on. Each person is born an infant, and every infant is subject from the first breath he draws and the first cry he utters to the attentions and demands of others. These others are not just persons in general with minds in general. They are beings with habits and beings who upon the whole esteem the habits they have, if for no other reason than that having them, their imagination is thereby limited. The nature of habit is to be assertive, insistent, self-perpetuating. So the truth of this place is that we are a people of habit, as all are, people who discover that we fit here, as many will. Not that we are superior, but that right now, right here, this is the place that fits us. We come down, if you were, or come up to this pre-existent religious community that practices habits, that make us feel at home. So I've been thinking about our money habits here. And as we get ready next weekend to launch our annual campaign of making promises to each other to fund this place of our dreams, I need to question some of those habits. I ask you to indulge me with this because I know talking about money sometimes gets people squeamish. We have a staff in this place that is providing phenomenal leadership. That's one of our habits. Our music director is helping to transform our church so that we are discovering new ways of making music together. My heart is touched every week as I enter this room of spontaneous and simple drumming done by anyone who chooses to come to this corner and make it happen. My spirit leaps with joy when one of our instrumentalists leads us in a topical or folk song, when our string ensemble delights us with a little Mozart, when our intergenerational chant choir shares a new arrangement of an old tune. Our music director, James Houston, is more than someone who shows up to do his time and collect his check. He cares about this place. For him, it's a habit. Our part-time sexton is working like a fiend to please you, checking up on the work of our cleaning crew, examining rooms used yesterday to see that they are ready for you today, helping to make coffee so that our hospitality volunteers can be even more hospitable. And by the way, here's a request. Don't allow her willingness to help out. Replace our need together to pitch in. Don't abandon her to the kitchen. Please, please. Jackie Cooper is juggling her new full-time job with her ability to serve us, and it is because she believes in us. She believes in us. She cares about this place. That's part of her habit. Many of you are just beginning to know our office administrator, Aubrey Ray, but the handful of volunteers who are here during the week working on bank deposits and financial reporting and the publications of the Beacon Monthly and the Weekly Order of Service, among many, many, many other tasks, are able to see another young worker who believes in the place that she works, believes in us, believes in our church. She does hope that we'll be more open to the ideas of a younger generation and more flexible in our approaches to things, yes. But she has those dreams because she believes in us and she cares about this place. And I will say it's not often that a report to the Board of Trustees receives applause. But when our Director of Lifespan Religious Education gave her report about the many committees we have and the ways we operate around here, applause is exactly what she got. Becky Brooks is a quiet and deep thinker, and don't you love the stories she presents to us twice a month? And she is able to categorize and rationalize this institution in a way that gives me much confidence. And I think the board felt that this week too. There are any number of places in the Baltimore, D.C. area that Becky might use her gifts as an educator. But she chooses to be with us and to be something of a church generalist on whom I especially can depend. She believes in us. She believes in us. We are for her a habit. In the next weeks, I hope that all of us will examine our habits as members and friends of this church, our participation habits, our leadership habits, our money habits. I know that you will all be invited to a fun kickoff event next Saturday evening. That'll be happening over there in just a couple of minutes. The cost of admission is a promise to make a promise, a pledge to make a pledge. We are changing our habits by finding fun ways to be intergenerational and family friendly, to be bold in expressing our expectations of each other, to be generous with one another in our time and our talent and our treasure. We're not afraid of a little April Fool's topsy-turvydom around here. Not afraid to learn a little from foolishness. Not afraid even to embrace the foolishness that says that we are more than individuals. Not self-made people and not abandoned selves out to do everything on our own. No, we are a community of people with habits of the heart that appreciate our forebears, yes, but which also trust our capacity to create new ways of being with each other, new habits, new friendships, the renewal of our souls, and the effective transformation of the world. The story of the fox and the cock is an unusual one among the Reynar stories, because the fox upsets the rooster by exposing his egoism around his voice, but the fox himself is exposed for the egoism of his wit. The rooster, caught in the mouth of the fox, taunts him to turn and boast to the farm widow and the animals who are in pursuit. And when the fox turns his head to say the medieval French equivalent of nya nya na nya nya, Chanticleer uses the opportunity of the fox's open mouth and mental distraction to leap out and to fly up into a tree. Both are revealed this time to be fools, and maybe we all are, you and I, maybe we all are, fools who love this transient life, fools who love this community, this church, our future, fools who choose to accompany one another on this journey for a while, for this while. May we ever be such fools. May such foolishness ever be. Amen.